welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and joining me this week, well, first, he's not a lonely child. Maybe he's an only child, but you can always find him waiting in the park. It's Dan. Hey, Dan, how you doing?
Doing okay. Yeah, I'm good. How you doing, Scott?
Another 24-karat gold contribution. Lovely. Okay, so next, like a little Tomb Raider, she's in charge of finding treasure in the dark. It's Jamie. Hey, Jamie.
Hey! Hey, guys.
And finally, the guy, well, you know, every little thing he does leaves an answer with a question mark. It's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Just so you know, me and my band, Terrible Internet, broke up, so I went solo, hopefully this week.
So I'm expecting some really sweet acoustic numbers later, you know. There. Get the harmonica ready. So we are here to chat up and break down the latest episode of Better Call Saul. That episode would be Axe and Grind, written by Ariel Levine, who also penned the fifth season finale, Something Unforgivable, as well as the second episode of this season, which was Carrot and Stick. And the episode was directed by none other than Giancarlo Esposito. And, of course, unlike Rhea Seehorn, who really did double duty, he didn't even appear in this episode. So,
meh. So, meh.
Lazy bones. Anyway. So, let's get into the very beginning of the episode, that cold open, what I call the little Kimmy flashback. Figure since she's young, we can call her Kimmy. Plus, we keep making that mistake with Jimmy and Kimmy and whatever.
Yep.
I'll just gonna say this, and then I'll start to throw it to you guys. I am struck by the beyond perfect casting of Kim's mom. This probably came up the last time because they did that other flashback with her. I guess it was a previous season. But again, I had to look her up just to make sure this woman wasn't related to Rhea Seehorn. She's not. Her name is Beth Hoyt. She's done several other things. But oh my God, it's the perfect casting. You know, there's moments where you think they're almost doing like one of those deep fake things and there's a little bit of Rhea Seehorn's face in her face. And you're like, nope, that's just the actress. And even, just really nicely cast. And the only other thing I want to mention before I just go to you guys and what you think about the cold open, that Nebraska license plate. Now, haven't we already been clued in before about Kim's Nebraska connection? We have been, right? I seem to recall that. And we also, you know, everything right down to even her having like the Kansas City Royals shirt, which I know is Missouri, but you know what I mean. I'm just wondering if once again they're throwing that in here as a hint or at least a tease of the possibility of perhaps maybe Kim exists in the Gene timeline or universe. So what did you guys my question is basically, and we can, you know, you can actually talk about things that happened during it. What did you think of this cold open flashback? And the second thing to go along with that, and again, because I'm all about the honesty when we're talking about these things, like I was last week when I was a little bit critical about things, was this a necessary flashback? I'm still entertained by it, so I'm fine with it, but I'm just wondering about that. So whoever would like to go first, and Jamie, if you'd like to go first, if you want to talk about a certain thing that appeared on the soundtrack.
You bet. You know it.
Well. We know we're going to talk about that.
we're gonna touch base on this really quick, because not only did it just make me happy because we got to hear Duran Duran on something, and let it be known, they don't just sell their music or little clips of the music to anything. They are, if they used Duran Duran, it's because Duran Duran is a fan of the show, period. Added to that, it was great because last week, weren't we just saying something? I don't remember who we were talking about, and you made a quip of like, yeah, I know it's not Duran Duran. It's like everybody in this podcast just sees the future. It's amazing. So I was pretty excited about that. And then, yes, we had great casting. We get to see where Kim's hairstyle was inspired. It is the same whenever her hair is down, same style, just down to the voice, you know, down to this woman's voice just being a near identical to Rhea's. It was pretty amazing. But the most important thing, other than just some of the like psychological, oh, we see where this is beginning and stuff, is the earrings that were involved with this earring necklace heist are the same pair of earrings that we have seen Kim wear always. It's always what she wears. It's always the same pair of earrings. And I think that's a pretty cool partnership. If you go over to, and look at the history of Slip and Jimmy and where it started, he too had a token from his first real con, and that ring that he wears, and we got lots of close-ups. So I thought that was a really exciting match.
Excellent catch on that. Nicely done. Brian, do you want to weigh in on it a bit?
I'll just say I agree that the casting was freaking uncanny. Like, I almost wanted to go back and watch it again just to make sure that it really wasn't Ray Seahorn with, like, digital changes. The voice, the mannerism of the voice were perfect. The other stuff, I agree with Jamie. I will answer your question, though. I do think it's important because here's why. There's two thoughts I had. First, when they did a Kim flashback, I didn't know if this week or next week was the finale. I couldn't remember. And I first thought, oh, my God, they're flashing back to her. She's going to die at the end of this episode. Like, my first thought was, oh, my God, we're doing a Kim flashback. And if this is the season finale, oh, my God. Like, that was my first thought. My second thought, though, was we have talked so much and the fandom has talked so much about how much of Kim's journey has been shaped by Jimmy. And what was he doing to her? And mm-hmm. This is where we learn that maybe he didn't need to push her. He just needed to give her a nudge, that this was always there. And that maybe whatever she felt about her mom and where the journey with her mom started, the last time we saw, she was pretty pissed at her mom and marching that cello across town and refusing to get right. in the car.
Yep.
Like, maybe her mom was more important to her and maybe they weren't as different as that last flashback told us. So I think this gives us just enough of a backstory to know that maybe Jimmy, whatever happens to Kim, it's really not Jimmy's fault. They just are two personality types that, you know, are bad for each other. And this gives her story, an added edge that more of this was her agency and was there all along and Jimmy didn't change
her. Right. And that little like hand hold that she had with her mom, it kind of gives us a quick window to realize that since we got to see the past moment in the parking lot with her cello and then had this to compare it next to, they told us pretty quickly that the only time her and her mother bonded or probably like felt bonded was with things like this.
Okay, excellent. It's interesting when I think about the type of person they established her mother to be and her relationship to her and how that one can look at her actions as a kid and what she did as, you know, this is her way of attaining her mother's approval, and this is what bonds her to her mom and whatever, because her mom's obviously a bit on the shady side, whatever. And then you contrast, but then you think about the person that she became and what she's been up until recently, and we're talking about how it's been slowly kind of been brought out in her by Jimmy, so to speak. And then you look at the reverse situation, or in borderline, when we recall the flashbacks we got as Jimmy as a kid. And his dad, who was the major parental influence there, who, if memory serves, and again, correct me if I'm misremembering this, which is always possible with me lately, pretty much a diametric opposite, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, dad was pretty much honest as the day is long, as opposed to Kim's mom, who maybe not so much. So it's interesting that one can say that Kimmy's way of doing something. She would do things to attain her mom's approval, whereas Jimmy was kind of going against the grain. You know, he was more the classic, rebelling against, you know, what his father was and represented, whereas Kimmy is kind of doing the opposite. That doesn't mean, of course, that Jimmy is now trying to reform, because he clearly is not. But I just think it's very interesting, because it becomes kind of like the nature-nurture kind of situation. It's like, oh, look at the impact this parent had on this child and where she went and look at how Jimmy formed as a kid and where he went. Did they ever establish, by the way, one last question about Kim? Because obviously, when we get little pieces of her backstory, like they're like precious little jewels, because we don't know that much at times. Is she an only child, or does she have siblings? Does anybody remember? I think she's an only child, but I'm not sure. I'm going to assume she... Do you know?
I'm going to assume she is. I don't remember any stories or any conversation that she talked about any siblings.
Okay. Yeah, because I guess they would have established one at this point. I just couldn't remember if maybe I missed something. Sometimes they might just throw a reference, you know, in an earlier season, because as a placeholder, just in case we want to come, you know, have a sister show up at one point or something. I didn't think so, but I wasn't sure.
I think with her and Nacho both, they've done a beautiful job of keeping the backstory vague enough that there's a lot of mystery to both of them. And in a show like we've talked about, where we know where all these characters are headed, that is sort of the mystique the show has kept, is that there are these two players on the board that we just have glimpses of and just know a little bit about. And so I think they've been very judicious doing it, and it's kept it very interesting.
Well, they've given them very minimal backstory, because they don't really have, for lack of better terminology, they don't really have a forward story, because we don't know them in the Breaking Bad world. We don't know about them. We don't know anything there like we do the rest of our cast. So not having much of their past actually suits that situation really, really well.
And the more factors they would give us, the more we'd compare against Breaking Bad and then we would be like, oh, well, that's bullshit. They'd never do that because of this or that. Yep. So, I mean, it's probably both a smart from a writer's perspective, but it also gives them a mystique that I think the story needs when you know most of the character's journey.
Yes.
Yeah, what I find really interesting, especially bringing up the Breaking Bad stuff, because I think about, obviously, all four of us, we had recently did a major Breaking Bad rewatch over the last few months, whatever. So we got to, you know, revisit all those characters from you know, episode one and on. And what I find interesting when I think about, because my comparing is not about whether this takes place beforehand, and it's, you know, then we know that, you know, I'm not comparing it on that level at all. I'm thinking about introducing the characters that we saw in Breaking Bad and how they built those characters, and how, you know, whatever exposition was given to us, it was like, you know, a bit here, but the main cast, at least, pretty much all felt very fully realized. You know, I didn't have many, I felt like I knew Skyler White, you know, within that first season and as we moved into the second one and so on. The same with a Jesse Pinkman or Walt or Hank. Marie, I think we get a little bit more on as we go on. Because she's a little bit more sketchily written than the others were, but they really filled in the blanks with her and especially Hank as we got through seasons two and into season three, whatever. But there isn't as much vagueness to go to how Brian was using the descriptor for the Better Call Saul stuff. I think with the Better Call Saul characters, they're, as you said, they're being a bit more judicious about it. I think they're also, it's kind of what you said, it's kind of like a writer's trick where they're also giving themselves enough room to move around so they don't get tied to anything. And so a lot of it depends more on the actor's performance. And when you have what Michael Mando and what Rhea Seehorn have done, both characters feel very lived in. And so even though we haven't really gotten a ton about Nacho over the 5 years, we kind of feel like we have. It kind of feels like it's there. We get the relationship between him and his father and what they were and what he's and why he's doing what he's doing and whatever. And even though his character does exist a lot to facilitate plot, it's still a great character. Besides Rhea Seehorn, and the Kim character, it's a much more intrinsic character to the whole Jimmy storyline, because she's as much of a mystery as Nacho was to us because of the weird little name drop from season two of Breaking Bad that we were all aware of. Kim was kind of like, who the hell is Kim? So we spent, you know, 5.5 seasons going, okay, but what's going to happen with Kim? And the more we learn about her past, we think it's going to help inform us about her future. And I like that they're doing that. So that's when I brought up the idea of, was this necessary or not? And I was comparing it to what I said last week when I thought we spent too much time in the episode on, both Gus and Kim are worried about Lalo. Yeah, we know. Thank you for spending like 7 minutes on that, guys. It wasn't 7 minutes, but you know what I mean. But here I was like, okay, I like that they're very, since they've already established from, you know, that they will occasionally do these little flashbacks. They don't do them very often. And I was like, okay, this is the right time for this. And it goes to exactly, it just basically confirms everything you guys have already said about, you know, why she's doing what she's doing all the way up to the last shot we see of this episode, in fact, why, when she makes that U-turn. It kind of goes back to this flashback, I think. So, anyway, enough out of me.
I want to know what Dan thinks. Dan hasn't chimed in.
He's dead. He died.
You know what? I think Dan may be in a trunk headed for the desert.
No, I'm still here. I was just listening to the podcast instead of saying anything. So, yeah.
Thanks for joining us as an avid listener.
Yeah, I enjoyed listening to the last podcast. Scott, I appreciate the research you did for the boxing scene, but next time wear gloves, please.
yeah, no one's asked me about that.
I thought it was not a wasted scene, and I thought it was really effective, like in the fact that it was, I mean, we're learning a lot about Kim, but it's done in kind of a subtle way, so you have to pretty much, if you have a brain, you can understand what's going on here, or if you care to watch TV in that way, you can understand, but it's not super obvious, you know, I mean, it's only obvious if you're paying attention.
Yes.
And I like that. Other than the fact that her mother has a questionable taste in music and parenting style. But...
I'm trying to think.
I'm just going to say we're marking that right up there with the camo Crocs, Dan. It's right there with the camo Crocs.
But I didn't buy the camo Crocs, though.
If you contemplate, you're out.
All right. Everybody stop before I start discovering if I'm able to mute people on the podcast myself here. All right. So we move on to Howard. What's interesting is now we get to meet Howard's wife, and we get to feel the coolness of their estrangement here. You know, everything from the ignoring or just obliviousness to his overtures for peace, you know, from the peace sign and the cappuccino to suggesting they attend an event together. And we then realize, sounds like they've been sleeping in separate quarters. And, you know, it's like you have to, on one hand, you have to love Howard's fastidiousness, because I'm always big on that. And there have been not the first character in the Vince verse to be that way. But here it's done, there's a certain sadness about it, especially after the wife leaves and him wiping down the table and whatnot. It's once again, it's giving us an opportunity to feel bad for Howard, you know, and we've been down that road before, but just this extra little taste of his life, much like the therapy session, you know, that we recently saw. And I feel like a lot of this is also building us to like, okay, you're making us feel worse about whatever this scheme is that they're pulling on him, because we really feel bad for the guy. But I think was it right after the scene is when we see him meeting up with the PI? I think it comes right after that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And at least there you get to see a bit more of the Howard getting a little bit of his mojo back. I love his little smile when the PI says there's no reason a lawyer would take out $20,000 in cash. Like, no legitimate reason. So I really kind of enjoyed our little taste of Howard here. So, you know, I think
for those people who kind of remember some of some information about Howard, I think him making this coffee for his wife is leading us into another story. If you remember, a while back we learned that Howard is allergic to caffeine, and so he can't have the coffee. But he's making the coffee for his wife. He's taking the time. He's telling us this story, but if you compare that into a couple of scenes moving forward with the veterinarian talking about, you know, it's like caffeine or Red Bull, I think that this is all going to come back to play in some way.
It's actually foreshadowing, and we're going to see Howard managing a Starbucks in Omaha in the future.
Oh, there you go.
In the same mall.
Right across the Cinnabon. Yep, that's it. Cracked the code.
I could see it.
Man, you talk about an odd couple, Gene and Howard. Wow.
Yeah. So, you mentioned the vet. We can go to the vet, and we can bounce back to Howard if anyone has anything else they want to say about that stuff. I loved the scene with the vet. It's one of my favorite scenes in the entire episode. I love that they brought this character back. It makes perfect sense that he would have been brought back at this point. And I really admire that they were able to, you know, go back and grab this character who goes back. Correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't he go all the way back to season one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. But the fact is, and here we have a way of ladling in another perhaps major aspect of the Saul Goodman character with this vet and his little black book. And of course, there's that little business card that we see in the little black book, and everyone, look what's there. Da, da, da. I really, and plus, you know, plus being a pet person, you know, the whole, I'm always gonna be partial to vets anyway. I just really got a kick out of this whole sequence, and then trying to figure out what was going on with the stuff with Jimmy's eyes and everything, and what that actually meant. I'll throw it to you guys to discuss now.
Well, that's kind of where I was going with on the Howard thing, because it really feels like this is, you know, obviously going to all come into. It's somebody is throwing something in Howard's drink, and I would assume that since they used the comparisons of caffeine and Red Bull, that Howard isn't going to handle this well. Like, his body isn't going to handle what they're about to hand him, I don't know. I'm scared for Howard. This isn't going to be good for them.
I suspect that they're going to, if we watched like maybe a season one episode that takes place in the HHM conference room, we might like, you know, see some kind of foreshadowing for like exactly like what Howard's drinking or how, and like that's going to come into play here since they're, you know, scoping out that location. But as to how they do it, who knows? But yeah, they're definitely just, you know, dropping something in there is going to dilate his pupils. But, you know, for all we know, they could end up, you know, killing him or something.
Yeah.
I had the thought, you know, what did Nacho do to, you know, old man Salamanca? Caused him to have a stroke.
Yes. There you
what
go.
If Kim causes Howard to have a stroke with caffeine? Yep. Like, you know, if those two characters' journeys have sort of been on a similar path, but on different sides of the story, you know, somebody who doesn't react well to caffeine, blood pressure is always a major concern. So, you know, like this going awry, that could happen. I'll say what I love about the vet is, like, you see a guy who's good at his job and loves what he does and does this stuff on the side and is just tired of it and wants out of it.
Yep.
And
he's sick of it.
Yeah. Like, in that black book, you know, I think there's a pretty good indication it could go to Jimmy. It could also go to Mike. Mike seems to always know who to call and who to get a hold of. You know, who's to say Mike doesn't end up with some of it, Jimmy ends up with some of it. Who knows? But that's sort of that's the key to the underworld in Albuquerque. And obviously, Jimmy knows it's very valuable. But it is great to see the vacuum card, you know, a nod to our favorite fixer. So I love this scene. Thought it was great. I love the way it was shot, from going from the one people to around the corner and there they were. I wondered why he was back, and I thought, this is super cool. Like, this guy hasn't been here in a while. I like the turn it took. I thought it was a great scene.
I also really like that we had the discussion between the two of them and Kim saying, you know, oh, well, he wants a clean break. Jimmy just being like, I don't understand this. Like, it's easy money. Like, why would you give this up? And she's like, no, I completely understand, like, getting a clean break and stepping away and starting something new.
It's also interesting because, again, when we're talking about a character like this in the Vinceverse, of think about, you know, broadening up from not just Better Call Saul, but the Breaking Bad as well. Characters who were involved in certain types of activities, and when they make a choice to double down on it, to pursue it further, or to get out of it, and to get out of it for the right reasons, not because they're, you know, afraid for their lives or something like that, which I guess is the right reason, but you know what I mean. So it's interesting that, no, this guy, his passion is actually being a vet, and he's done this on the side, and he's, you know, he's obviously made some coin on it, but he's like, okay, I've done this enough. I just want to concentrate on being a vet, because that's what I actually love to do, and I don't necessarily really want to do this anymore. And he can, from what we know at least, which is obviously very little, it seems like he should be able to do that. And it's more of a matter of, like, just who's going to end up with that little black book. Yeah, I guess it could be Mike, but I just feel that it feels like this is part of what makes Saul Goodman character in the future. Also intriguing,
the guy who knows a guy.
Right. It's also intriguing if you were to look more into what was going on with that little black book, and you know. Google stuff online and articles and whatnot, and you'll discover things about the code that's in there and things that are actually listed if you freeze frame and whatever. And what may very well be an entry that was supposed to have been Nacho that has been crossed out in the book, indicating that they already know that Nacho is no longer with us, and he's been crossed out in the book, which is pretty incredible. And apparently there's certain ciphers one can kind of use to... One can go down a crazy path where you start trying to figure out what different things mean on a page. And I was like, you know what? This isn't 2009. I'm not watching Lost. I'm not going that crazy here. I'm good, guys. I'm fine. But if you want to, for those who really like doing that kind of thing, it's all online. You know, you can spend an hour or two figuring it all out and get back to us.
Report back. Send an email.
Oh, Jamie, just to, before I, you know, it was funny because I was so out of it when I was first watching this, and I had to rewatch a little bit because I was watching it way too late. When he looks in the mirror to see the effect on his eyes after, and obviously you were talking about the dilation, whatever. I was so out of it for a second there. I was like, wait, are they changing his eye colors? Is he going Bowie on us, or
what's happening?
Is he Max Scherzer? What? Anyway, okay, let's get back to the episode, and we have Kim at the courthouse. So, question. I kind of thought the scene with Kim at the courthouse, and, you know, when Cliff Maine walks in to watch what happens there, it's kind of, in a weird, on one hand, it's almost the closest that a show like Better Call Saul gets to sort of kind of commenting on social issues, although I know one could certainly argue that both Better Call Saul and even Breaking Bad have had a lot to say about things like immigration and drug use in this country, or even gender inequality. But here, this very specific, it seemed, I mean, I'm not saying it wasn't subtle. It wasn't like over the top or anything, but I was thinking this is kind of a little bit of an opportunity for them to kind of, you know, point something out. And Brian, I did think of you specifically while watching that scene. It's like, oh, I'm thinking Brian must be enjoying this textbook kind of thing. You know, he's probably done this before.
Oh, it's totally a argument lawyers make regularly, and it is the idea of the pretextual stop, that a police officer makes up a reason to stop someone and just comes up with any random, you know, traffic violation. Like, you know, the big ones are broken taillight or got too close to the yellow line. I like that Kim is industrious enough to say, like, hey, I went through the parking lot and, like, most of the cars have air fresheners. I mean, mm-hmm. It's such a stupid reason to pull somebody over. It was done in a way. Her argument actually was pretty good. But in true criminal law form, when she walks out with Clifford Maine and he says that was a great argument, and she says what we all say, yeah, I guess we'll have to see what the judge rules. Now, you know, most of the time we make those arguments and they fall on deaf ears. But I thought the argument, the presentation of it, and her framing of the issue for a shortened time period for that scene was really good.
So I'm going to tell you guys a fun story. I got pulled over for one of those Christmas tree air fresheners hanging around my rearview mirror in rural Minnesota one time. And that was the only reason I got pulled over. And then while he was talking to me about it, I was like, okay. So I pulled out a knife and I cut it down. him <stand. laughs> And I look at him and it's like, oh, I guess I could have waited for that. And he just shook his head.
I like, in my mind, I'm making it like a really big knife. like a Rambo Crocodile Dundee kind of job. It's like, wait, is this is legal, right?
So here's the question, Dan. Did he ask you if you had anything in the car, and did he give you a ticket?
No, I'm white. He didn't give a fuck. He just wanted exactly. to call me over.
Exactly. That was my point. And you also, like, he shook his head at you once you produced a deadly weapon because you're white. So,
yeah. Yeah. I got away with being a bonehead.
Oh, you got an air freshener. Well, get on down the road. You betcha to do it.
Oh, yeah. I would say I was about 45 minutes from Brainerd or Bemidji. So I was definitely in that neck of the woods.
Your car's looking dirty. You need to go wash it.
Oh, but it's smelling pretty good there. It smells like that strawberry Christmas tree or whatever, eh?
Poor Scott. He can't handle this bunch tonight.
Nah, it's fine. I like that. That was actually pretty good. So when Kim walks out of the courtroom and she has that little conversation with Cliff Maine, what I really liked about it, I love that I felt that she absolutely said the right thing about Howard and the law firm. I was like, oh, that is, I don't know if you planned this, that you thought that Cliff Maine would show up here or not, but man, that was like exactly what you should have been saying. So I was kind of impressed by that. I mean, of course she would say the right thing. I didn't think she'd be flustered or anything, but I just remember thinking, that's exactly what you should say there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I got to get to this now. Kim. We're with Kim, and she goes to the new digs for Saul Goodman. And we get the Kim and Francesca scene and the waiting room decor. Oh, man.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Which
was both professional and refined.
Right. And this is one of those great gags because we know this is the location and we know what the decor of that waiting room is going to be.
Right.
And in a way, the waiting room is like a reflection of Francesca then. And the waiting room is a reflection of, and when you get to Breaking Bad, it's a reflection of Francesca a couple years later. And this episode alone kind of really shows, you mentioned jokingly before about foreseeing or being psychic about things in previous podcasts. Did I not, like, just the last podcast talk about, like, oh, I'm curious to see the downfall of Francesca, if we're going to see how she goes from this to what we see in Breaking Bad. Like, hey, you know what? They accelerated that in this episode. they went right to, like, yeah, this is how. This is what happens. The jading becomes fast and furious with Francesca.
Yep. I like to think that when we got this scene where she's just slowly looking around the room to the clientele, and then that cigarette gets put out on her, like, her lovely day chair. Oh, man. It's like starting to occur to her at that point, like, that you see her, not so much that her tastes change, but that she starts to cater to the clientele. And what it gives us an idea of what she kind of thinks of the clientele. Like, this is the room you're worthy of, not this room that I originally had.
That's interesting. I mostly agree. I think it's more, my interpretation is from where she starts here and where we see her ending up, is it's more like, it's not caring anymore. It's like, this isn't, you know.
Well, you're just going to ruin anything nice, right. You know.
But I love little touches where you can see Kim is processing this. And she, and while she doesn't say it here, you do feel in Kim's mind, like, well, the whole, because she's helping to craft the whole Saul Goodman image and what she imagines.
Yes.
This waiting room is not Saul Goodman. And there's that shot where you can just see her just looking at the frilly curtains. And it's just behind her, and it's like, yeah, this doesn't feel right. I mean, we don't get to have that her actually say that, but I feel you kind of see it on her face. And plus we already know, that we don't know. I don't know if they'll make it throughout the rest of the season, but we know this decor is not going to last very long.
No. We go from molding to wood panel.
Oh yeah,
and I think it's great that they sort of do a callback to the toilet. When she talks about, well, I'm going to have some water treatments. And then, you know, the dude pees in the water treatment. When, so, you know, they remove the toilet, but then, right. Like, the dude uses the place like it would have been better off with the toilet.
Exactly.
The toilet.
I thought the urination was a total callback to this. I was like, you know, if you just left the toilet there, like Kim said,
we wouldn't be going through this.
Instead of the whole running water thing there.
this episode with Francesca here, it's also kind of, you know, neat to note and think about how resistant she is to making this, like, just, you know, a pretty innocuous phone call, pretending to be somebody else to get information. Yep. While we know that in the future she without hesitation will make a phone call, like, you know, pretending that Marie's been in a car accident, you know, same scenario here. So she definitely changes over time.
That's excellent. I think that's incredibly deliberate, and it's a shot to anyone who actually remembers that, and which you do, thankfully, because it's like, wow, that's like night and day. So excellent. Best catch of the pod so far. So we bounce into Jimmy's office, or Saul's office, and we see that they're preparing for a video shoot. And this is the thing that I care about in this whole scene. I don't care about the episode at this point. I don't care about the plot. I don't care about any of that. You know what I care about? We get a Mr. Show reunion, people.
Yes.
Mr. Show reunion. More important than Better Call Saul. John Ennis, who's one of the cast members throughout the run of the sketch comedy series, which was, by the way, the best sketch comedy series since Monty Python. Fuck you, Kids in a Hall. And I like Kids in a Hall, but come on. Mr. Show is 50,000 times funnier than that. Or SNL. Anyway. Here we see that John Ennis is going to, he's playing a character named Lenny, who's the guy that they've chosen they're in the middle of trying to choose just the right stash for it, because he's going to be posing as this Casimiro character that we're sort of kind of piecing together what's going on. I'll confess I wasn't totally clear on what was happening, but I did kind of get the sense of it, because I paused on looking at the newspaper headlines like, okay, I think I see where we're going here. But I'm sorry, I was just so thrilled to see a Mr. Show person here. I almost blanked out on the scene. I had to go rewind back. I was like, oh, I'm so excited. Is David Cross going to show up next? But
I love that they poke fun at acting with this guy. Like what's my motivation? And Jimmy's like, it's a picture. he's trying to get all into the character, and it's great. But I'll tell you what we see here too is probably the most telling moment in this is Kim's the one that comes in and picks the hairpiece and says, if you just do this and do that, he'll look perfect. Like she's the missing ingredient to making this shot work, to making this character look convincing.
And I was really just happy to have that film crew back again, because they're always a lot of fun. Like every scene that they've ever participated in has been such a fun scene.
And if memory serves, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, the most hysterical thing about them beyond what we see in any of these episodes is when you look a little further and you realize, oh, they've never given them names. They're all like, I think she's like makeup girl. Like, I think it's something. Each one is just whatever it is they do, which is almost, it's almost goofing on just the business. And who's best boy? Who's gaffer? Key grip. And since you mentioned Kim coming in, and so they have that conversation. She has that conversation with Jimmy about what had happened between her and Cliff Maine. I really just appreciate and it kind of goes back of how we were kind of waving off those who had said that there wasn't a true bond between these two characters, because the genuine affection and encouragement that Jimmy is giving her, and quite frankly, the positivity of Jimmy about this, which is, I still think it's a very uniquely Jimmy McGill quality that is not quite a Saul Goodman quality in the same way, but it's more about their genuine affection and the loving relationship that these two have. So I really like that little bit of business there. And of course the lunch, and now they also set up the plotting of it. Oh, of course the special lunch meeting is going to be the same day as the supposed, D-Day or when everything's going to happen. So, it's like, we're like, all right, we already know something's going to go wrong to change that. So I kind of got a big kick out of that. Should we bounce over? Well, should we bounce to Germany? I think we should, because we haven't talked about Lalo yet. And we see that Lalo has tracked down that dude who is the one who apparently sent Marguerite that Lucite preserved slide rule that we were talking about. He's a man with an axe. Is it the axe that's in the title of the episode? Maybe. Don't know. It's kind of nice he does temporarily get the jump on Lalo, and that lasts, I don't know, a minute, minute and a half before Lalo turns the tables on him. So,
I mean, I don't know though. Like, if some guy that looked like Lalo came to my middle of nowhere cabin and he had a weapon, I'm not sure that I would give much time for talk. Like, I think I would be like so out of there, or I would do what I could to take him down. Like, there would be no conversation, because that's some scary shit. Straight up, like, there's a stranger and this guy looks like a badass.
Jamie's pulling his German card.
Yeah, yep. Yoink. That's what she said.
Wow. Well, what she did.
That's what she did.
But so, did anyone actually or genuinely remember that person as part of the crew that was working with the deceased gentleman whose name just flew out of my head?
Werner.
Thank you, Werner. Mason Berger. What? Oh. No, I can't remember.
Yeah. No, I figured they're going to use that guy that like we thought was going to be a pain in the ass and then wasn't.
Yeah.
I didn't remember any of the other ones.
Right.
Was this that guy?
Mm-mm. No, this
it wasn't him, right? Because I remember, it was the obnoxious, because we thought it was going to be the obnoxious guy who we thought they were going to kill him. Nope, that's not who they're going to kill. Memories of death. Oh, I never said that about the French. I forgot to say something about the French. I kind of said that about the Francesca stuff. Never mind. Okay. I said that. That was all about filling in that character blank that we were wondering about. So then we'll bounce over to Mike then. So when that the next scene that begins with Mike when he's at the laundry, and one of the very first things we see is him helping to grab some laundry and put it back in a basket that got fell out. What is it with all these people who have to be so perfect and fastidious? I mean, even I thought, wow, is it just showing that Mike's just a really nice guy that he did that? Anyway, so what I did say in a previous podcast, remember, is that Tyrus seems to be the one dude who does not seem to be one of quote-unquote Mike's guys. So I'm going to say that little confrontation between them, pretty much if there was anyone on Earth who doubted that, yeah, he's definitely not one of Mike's guys. He's purely a Fring right-hand man, dude. So this whole little showdown between them about how Mike is deploying his men was a lot of fun, because I also think that while I think you have Mike, who's probably one of the most beloved characters from Breaking Bad, as well as on this show. He could probably just have a show to himself, quite frankly. And I think Tyrus is one of the people that people tended to hate the most, in a good way. You know, we love to hate him, character from the Breaking Bad days, especially. So having these two actually have yet another kind of face off, and we've had that before, but now it was just with more words spoken between them. It was really fucking satisfying. I really enjoyed this a lot.
Yeah, Mike being, I mean, Mike is always ready when he believes in something. He's ready to just go, we can settle it now, or you can do what I say. And, you know, he picks those spots, and it was satisfying to see him back Tyrus down here.
And also, did you notice when Tyrus leaves, I don't know how to phrase this right, but I'm going to say, it's like he takes special care not to bump into Mike as he walks past him. Because it was one of those moments where you think, oh, he's going to give him a shoulder. And he scrupulously kind of avoids that. Which also tells me that Tyrus is not an idiot either, because, okay, I'm not going to escalate this. Now is not the time to do this, but maybe another time. But, I really the stuff we get with Mike in this episode is really kind of enjoyable. I really got a kick out of it. Now, the whole thing was about the fact that I think Mike says something about, the men, they're running thin with the men. So where they play on there, their issue is that he has these people on Alameda Street. And we find out that Alameda Street is basically where his daughter-in-law and granddaughter live.
Yep.
And their issue, the issue that Tyrus brought up, was he had taken people off his own home. Now, the thing I don't understand, I don't understand Tyrus and Fring, or maybe it's Gus Fring's reasoning here. Shouldn't they understand that Mike would obviously be more concerned about his actual family than his own home? And if they already point out that Lalo knows who he is, and they already know how resourceful Lalo is, and I doubt it would take that much effort for Lalo to figure out who Mike's family is. So wouldn't they, of course, be far more at risk and susceptible to Lalo, because he would, try to use him to try to get at Mike, whatever. So wouldn't, therefore, it make more sense then for to have people watching them than even his own home? So I just didn't see their logic. I kind of was disagreeing with them on that one.
Okay, I could completely could have just forgotten a whole chunk of storyline here. But I I want to believe, or I feel that it's, I don't ever remember Gus actually knowing about Mike's family until the end of Breaking Bad. Like towards the end of Breaking Bad, when he's, when they figure out where this money is being, like why he's, what he's doing with his money. I feel like he, this is where we see Mike separate from his granddaughter and his daughter-in-law. Like that's why we got this scene, because in all of Better Call Saul, pretty much everything that we've seen with him and his granddaughter, they've been together. He's been babysitting her or bringing her a dog or whatever. They share their lives with each other. But everything in Breaking Bad is from a distance, over the phone, with binoculars. Like they're not spending time together. So well, when he talks about his job, is there times that I'm forgetting?
He spends time with his granddaughter a few different times. Even when he's on the run at the end, he leaves her in the playground and he leaves her there.
Right. So. He leaves her there. Okay, I recall that.
No problem.
But I don't know, I just feel like that there's not a lot of information there that it's just too big of a hole for these writers to just like overlook. I feel like that we're supposed to just assume they don't really know much about, you know, that this is where the separation is. So he's always kind of keeping an eye on them. Like he wants to watch them and he wants to make sure they're okay. And they think he's, you know, in an entirely different city working, and it gives him an out to be gone all the time.
I think this is just a Tyrus thing. Like, you know, Tyrus has an issue with Mike, so he's just kind of fucking with him a little bit by saying, you know, I don't care about your family. I don't care. You know, fuck you, Pop.
Wow. Dan's newest bumper sticker.
No, that makes more sense. I mean, because, I think that's more spot on.
Okay.
There's
have been missing parts of it that I just don't remember. So
there's no way that someone like Gus Fring
wouldn't know that he had family.
No, he would know. That goes without saying.
But remember, that was such a big, I guess that's just why it stood out to me, because that was such a big turn of events in Breaking Bad, when the realization of where, like, what this money was going, and them taking the money and everything that he'd saved up for his granddaughter was now gone. And
that was the reveal to us. It wasn't a reveal to Gus. Us is not Gus. Okay.
Yeah. And I don't think
new title. I don't think, this is Gus.
If Mike could tell him why there were men on Alameda Street and there weren't men in other places, I don't think Gus would tolerate that. Like, if there were men watching a house that nobody knew why they were watching that house, Tyrus would go to Gus and Gus would be like, what are you doing? Like, I think Gus would have to know why those men were there for Mike to be able to make that play.
I just removed a chunk of storyline from my head.
It's all coming clear now.
I think it's more about the fact that they don't, what we've seen with Gus, but one thing the show's actually, I think, has filled in for us, because we kind of speculated about it when we were talking about Breaking Bad, when we did the Breaking Bad podcast, is we see no evidence that Gus has any family life at all. The house, it's just him. There's no evidence. There's no evidence of children or wife, whatever. Obviously, we also know that, well, the implication is if he did have anything like that, it would be a beard anyway, as they say. You can say he wouldn't relate to that. We also know that Gus doesn't really have a soft spot for children, if you remember Breaking Bad and how all that stuff kind of goes down. Yeah. So the fact that he would even have anything to say about, their resources being stretched, why is he wasting it on watching, you know, where his daughter-in-law and specifically his granddaughter would be? But I kind of want to go with Dan on this one, that it feels a little bit more like a Tyrus kind of a thing. I think Mike might even possibly sense that when he says, you know, if the boss has a problem, he knows how to call me. And if you have the problem, if it's you, I'm right here. So I think that was kind of his way, almost addressing that in that moment.
I think there is a possibility that Gus doesn't really know much about Mike's family also, because it was established that Gus didn't know that Hank was related to Walt until he toured the DEA offices. So there's always a chance they just do some sloppy, stuff, because he just, you know, didn't know that. And it was, and was in business with him. But, you know, probably not.
I'd have to think about that, because it seems odd that there will be times where he does a full, I mean, they've shown Mike acting as a PI on Gus's behalf to right. do background check something, but then you do have that issue with the Hank and Walt thing, so which is almost like an odd little plot hole on Breaking Bad, actually. So that's absolutely correct. But should we assume, my thing is, should we assume that he has a pattern of being that lax? I don't know. Maybe. It's one of those things, it doesn't make sense for someone who's so circumspect as Gus Fring, but the Hank revelation does kind of stick out. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting.
Yeah. And Tyrus does kind of frame this as like, he doesn't really, you know, they're keeping all these, you know, people watching these places because they're expecting Lalo to show up there. And he was saying that the house, he thinks it's a long shot that they would show up there. So, right. You know, presumably Gus and Tyrus do know that it's his family.
That part I don't think is in question. I'm sorry. Yeah. I don't even think that's open. No offense. I don't think it's open for debate.
No,
other things are. But that Hank thing, well, we should have fucking talked about that on the Breaking Bad podcast. Well, how'd I miss that? Can we go back and re-record that? Anyway. So the other thing that's interesting, after we get the moment with Mike actually talking with his granddaughter and, you know, with the stargazing and whatnot, and you guys can talk about that more if you want. I think it's nice because we're remembering that Mike actually might have more to lose than almost anybody else, because of actual family that's mm-hmm. still alive. And it's also how Mike perhaps retains his humanity, his soul above all else. And I think it also feeds to, like what I was saying before, a lot of times he is the person that we tend to root for the most in this series. Yeah, I'm gonna put it out there. Was it hashtag fight me, whatever. I'm gonna say people actually root for Mike more than they root for Jimmy and Kim. Yeah, that's right, I said it. Just because he's
fun. Well, that's because Mike doesn't do things for his own. He doesn't do things on a whim for his own selfish gain or desire. It's always on behalf of integrity to the job he's doing, or in love of his granddaughter.
Right, right. It's an interesting form of purity with him. It's mm-hmm. and as we said oft times before, it's always easy to appreciate a character who definitely lives by a code, and what he does, even if what he does is not the most reputable thing, if he does it with a sense of honor or code, he becomes a character that we embrace. And the example we always got, especially a character who actually always referred to a code, is someone like an Omar on The Wire. I mean, Mike is like that to me on this. You know, it's like,
right.
So that's why I always say, I think as much as we love Odenkirk as Jimmy / Sol, or how much we've expressed our affection for Kim, for Reyes Thorne's Kim, and so on and so forth, I'm still going to say at the end of the day, I think Mike's the favorite character on this and the most beloved character on the show. That's my view, at least.
Mike's a man you can set your watch to. You know, you can trust that. You can trust Mike. You might not like what the reality is, and you might not like what the truth is, but you can always trust you'll get the truth with Mike.
And you know, the thing to leapfrog off what you said, Scott, Mike is respected and liked and admired, not just because he treats his granddaughter well, he treats his daughter-in-law well.
Yes.
Like a lot of people wouldn't maintain that relationship.
Right.
But out of a sense either of duty or guilt to her, I mean, he is good to her too. And is respectful of her, doesn't try to intrude on her relationship with the granddaughter. So, I mean, like his sense of family isn't one that so many directly involved in their world, but are on the periphery, they are used for what they're valuable for.
Yeah.
Like he's not, like he never uses his family for anything and never says they're an excuse. He doesn't talk about them. He doesn't say, I'm just doing this for my grandkid. Like he keeps them out of it.
Right. He's the opposite of certain other characters in the Vinceverse who always use a fallback. I'm doing this for my family. I'm doing
yes, for exactly.
Exact opposite. Exactly. And it also, it reminds us then just how important and significant that episode back in season one was. Was it 5-0? The basically the Mike backstory episode, which in that one episode pretty much it filled in any blanks we would ever need filled in for Mike, and it informs everything that we see him do for the rest of this series, as well as what we saw him do on Breaking Bad. And which is why I think it's such an important episode for that character. I mean, it's probably the most important episode for that character, quite frankly. So when you see these moments with his granddaughter, I mean, there's something just so charming and fun about it. You know, like the thing about Jupiter and the gas giant, like, you know, well, not that kind of gas, pop, or whatever. It's just great. You know, it's a cool
nugget to learn that Mike knows the constellations.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though he should know that if you're in the middle of a major city, you probably can't see them, but, you know, there's that.
There's always a chance. There's a telescope. I mean, he did tell her not too much light, so yeah, he's a little aware.
Yeah, telescope, and depends what's really actually. So we'll go to Jim and Kimmy, and by the way, I love that little aquarium still that they've kept in their apartment all this time. I also love the post-it board because it reminds me of when I was studying for a bartending exam like 5 years ago. And I think I have the picture somewhere buried on my Facebook page and one of those albums or something. It looks just like that. It's multicolored cards all lined up all perfectly, whatever.
Well, and I'm going to say for those who do like to just kind of like the same people that are looking at that black book and kind of want to try to figure out, like, decipher this code, it's get a still shot of this board, and it's really fun because their whole is written out in pictures.
It's like a rebus.
It's a storyboard.
Yeah. Yep, exactly. All the way down to, like, Viola, you know, who she talked to about the judge, and it's really fun. It's fun to put together.
So we go from there, and they're going to go have a little late-night wine picking on what they refer to as Omaha Beach, which obviously is, you know, just outside the offices of HHM, and we see how convenient. It's nice and convenient that they can look right into the conference room. I love how the architecture just happens to be right perfect for their little their little soiree with their wine there. So later, I guess the next day, you know, when plans are supposed to go into action, when he's about to buy that bottle of that expensive tequila that they like so much, and that's when he spots the actual guy that they were having Lenny pose as in the on the photos, actually. Sorry. So, and the whole situation is the guy clearly has a broken arm, which they did not plan on, or apparently was not depicted in those photos and or video, whatever was shot before. So, oh no, the plan has gone awry. And I love when a plan goes wrong with Jimmy and you kind of see him trying to, like, calculate. The interesting thing is usually he comes up with a way around it. And here he just wants to stop. You know, we'll do it another time. And it's Kim who wants to push on when he gives her the call. So, I mean, we can just talk about that because obviously, you know, the flashback and the scene with Kim at the end are the bookends of the episode for a reason. And Kim is both figuratively and literally the driving force of what happens at the end and going into the next episode. So I wanted to hear what you guys felt about this little scene between them.
Well, first, can I say that to touch back on the Omaha beach, did anyone else feel like it was incredibly risky for them to just be like hanging out, peering into the windows, like this boardroom that you know this is where shit's going to go down? So that's the first thing. Second, just a little thing that wasn't mentioned when he was in the liquor store purchasing the tequila. The guy was like, well, you know, this, the top is really sharp, so be careful. Maybe that might come back around for us. But then his need to call Kim instead of solving the problem, I think, is a pretty clear indication that it is known and understood. She is the one calling the shots. She is the one in charge of this plan. She is the mastermind. She's the leader, because he didn't come up with a Saul plan. Or, you know, he called the boss. And it kind of reminded me of some of the scenes that we see in Breaking Bad when things kind of start to go awry and he gets out those phones and starts making some calls.
Yeah, and it's his degree of anxiety is heightened over what we typically see when he's facing, you know, a hiccup in a plan, and he's very nervous, which I think tells us the scope of this is a little more audacious than anything they've done before. And you know, normally he would try to go with the flow or figure something out, and he's completely thrown off. And he doesn't even call her to say, like, hey, we need to make an adjustment. He just says it's over, like we're calling it off.
Yeah, it's done. Like, let's call it off.
So I thought that was a real interesting thing that that he went from, like, we're going to do it to we're not going to do it that quick, and had that level of anxiety about the whole thing.
Yeah.
He also curses, which is interesting. See, that's not something he does very often. And they let him use the big one.
So now he's at the liquor store and they get him a bottle of $500 booze from behind the counter. Would they then just have to walk around the store with it? Is that the way it would work? Because it doesn't seem like super likely that they wouldn't just, you know, bring him up or, you know, let him walk around.
Yeah, just bring it over to the counter themselves and then ring it up and then put it in his hands. Yes.
Yeah, because, you know, $500, but I don't go to a lot of liquor stores and buy stuff that's that expensive, so I could be wrong. But
wait, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think it's a safe assumption they would have brought it over to the counter and rung it up at that point.
Oh, okay. I was trying to figure what the hell you were talking about. I got lost on that. I didn't. No, I didn't. I mean, no offense. I just had. I had no idea what the fuck you guys were talking about. I was like, here's the tequila. You were gonna buy it. I don't know what's the complication.
I give you buy. It's a transaction.
I just wasn't following. My fault, probably. I'm sure. I'm trying to think if there's anything else here. I mean, I mean, like I said before, the fact that she literally does a U-turn and, you know, right over the divider. I think it's like,
didn't crash this time. She didn't crash.
Right. No, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
And she's, you know, I think it's, you know, pretty obvious what they're, you know, that symbolizes too, since she's, you know, turning away from the good path and heading towards the bad path.
I've kind of turned on her own bad. Yep. She's hitting that road.
I've kind of have a theory that I've been kind of cooking up that in Breaking Bad, when Saul manages to set up this drug deal with Gus for Walt, and of course doing that through his PI doesn't make sense. I wonder if they're going to continue this Mike-Kim relationship thing, and she ends up being the one that's kind of more involved with the stuff, and you know, Saul sets it up kind of through her. So it would take a little bit to get there, but I certainly think it's possible.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, Mike's willing to, you know, Mike has, you know, more respect for her in certain ways than he does. Well, probably every way that he does for Jimmy. So So there's always a chance that that'll continue to grow, and maybe she'll have, you know, some part, maybe, you know, if she ends up playing some part in, like, you know, them whacking Lalo or something, you know, who knows what could happen. But I could, you know, we could end up seeing something like that actually happen from that. Because if Saul and Kim are together at that point, you know, who knows?
That brings a whole lot of interesting thoughts into play.
I know, right?
Such as. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, I mean, like, you know, you just think, like, could Kim end up representing people at odds with, like, their organization, and, you know, Mike kills them, and it causes friction with Jimmy, and Jimmy and Kim, you know, get upset that you know, there's some, or, you know, say something crazy, say that Mike and Tyrus get busted. Could Jimmy represent Mike and Kim has to represent Tyrus, and that, you know, like, I mean, anything like that could happen that could cause them, both being lawyers, to end up in some very tricky situations. And so, I mean, to follow Dan's logic, that could get interesting. I mean, my theory has always been it would be really curious if she ended up as general counsel at Madrigal and was in Germany, you know, or somewhere else in Houston or something, because Mike thought she was solid and we needed somebody handling legal work because she's stand up. But I want to add something I don't think anybody has researched or found that's an interesting piece of trivia. The Jackson Mercer Foundation is not a real foundation that I can find. And I believe, and this is totally a guess, if I'm wrong, somebody send us an email. I mean, hey, we haven't gotten one in a while. If you want to shit on me, I go for it. But the last two names of the person running the Justice Foundation, for one of the largest charitable racial justice foundations in the country, is a woman named Cynthia Jackson Mercer. And she was just named the chair of the Equity and Justice branch of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, which, if you listen to NPR, is often philanthropy groups. So my guess is that someone, a writer or someone, threw that name in as a, you know, as sort of a an Easter egg or a tribute or something to her.
To you, another Hewlett,
and so. To me, because their name actually is spelled the right way. So
I reckon they'd be beer info.
That there's your can.
Wow.
I don't give millions of dollars. I actually go defend people, but, you know, hey, every dollar helps, I guess.
Some people have jobs to do, you know.
I saw a Hewlett Packard truck in one scene. Was that a reference to you, Brett? No, I'm just kidding. Anyway. So let's talk more about Duran's written on this.
Any day, all day, you got it.
Oh, I could tell you stories. Huh? I'll wait till after the podcast for those stories. All right. Is there anything else that we didn't touch on that anyone would like to mention before I wrap this up? I'll give you 5 seconds before I choose to move on. 5, 4, 3.
Do you think Gus is aware of what Lalo's doing? Like, he realizes, like, there can only be one thing that Lalo's up to right now? Since there's only so many things that, like, he's doing that are a vulnerability where the cartel is concerned. Like, making the super lab is one of them. So I definitely got the impression last week that he probably has a good idea what's going on.
Yeah, he's using his Frank superpowers to solve this.
Yeah, when we were talking about it last time, the fact that Gus is clearly planning something on the site of where they're building the super lab, but even to the extent of, like, stashing a gun in the treads of that caterpillar thing over there, whatever you call it, the digging device thing there. So he's obviously knows this is going to be a staging ground for a confrontation, and who else is going to be but Lalo? So yeah, and that was it. It's the Fring. You know what? I don't want to give him that much credit. I don't want, I mean, we're being a little silly with Gus Frings and his, you know, his spidey senses of knowing what's going to come. But we also, it was established that they know that Lalo knows about some of this from what happened with the fellow whose name I keep forgetting for some reason. Because Werner. Of the phone call, Werner, thank you. Because of the phone calls he had placed and all that. So we already know he knows something about that. And now, how they know this would be the thread that Lalo would be choosing to try to pull on, that I don't know. That's psychic otherworldly shit. But
and we also know Lalo will reincarnate as a fly.
All right. Okay. No. Dan, don't worry. Brian is never going to replace you.
That does kind of sound like some of the dumb shit that I would come up with. So well done, Brian.
That's fun. He's going to come back as a
funny one-eyed, guy. He's funny guy.
Going to be giving me card as a one-eyed teddy bear. All right. So I'll at least start to do the wrap up. We can still talk about stuff after it. Don't worry. So everyone out there, if you enjoyed this podcast, and I can't imagine you did. I mean, didn't. I mean, wouldn't. I mean, well, would. You know what? You'll enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page as well. It's the Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page. You can join the conversation about shows like Better Call Saul and so many others. Where can you find us? Well, you're already listening to us, so you already found us. Why am I telling you where to find us? But you can find us pretty much wherever podcasts are available. You know, your Apple, your Amazon, and so on. But better still, you can just go to stvdpodcast.podbean.com, where you can find all 343 of our podcasts. Jesus Christ. I think our season's about to end soon, too. Our quote-unquote, I think our season ends in late May. So, wow. The last episode of Better Call Saul, first half, will be the last episode of this season of the STVD podcast. Just realized that. No one knows or cares, but I know that. Anyway, follow us on Instagram. Our handle there is Serious TV Drama is one word. And please follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is at STVD Podcast. STVD as in Serious TV Drama. Next week, we will be covering the final episode of the first half of the final season. Oh, whatever, you know, the mid-season finale. Which is titled Plan and Execution. After we've done that, I will mention a few things about some podcasting plans of what we may be doing in between, in the little waiting period between the two halves of the season. So, anything else you guys want to talk about, or we want to wrap it up or what?
I have a question for you, Scott.
Oh, good. Have my hand.
No. Jamie got a Duran Duran reference. Mm-hmm. Dan got an explicit KFC reference. Obviously get my, you know, courtroom defending people reference. What do you want the writers and producers of Breaking Bad, what bone do you want them to throw you next week, since we've been on quite a roll of things of things being like uncannily connected to our personal lives? What bone do you want next week?
Wait, what is the thing we're saying is connected to you? Or you're just going with the whole legal thing in general?
Well, you know, this week, like, if you believe the foundation, it's actually by people who have the same last name as me.
Okay. All right. Okay. I wasn't really paying attention when you were talking before. I'm just kidding. I was drinking my 7-Up. Well, I love pop quizzes at the very end of a podcast.
There you go.
What would be an appropriate bone to throw someone like me? I don't know. I'd have to think about it. You know, I mean, hell, it could be something dorky. Like any random comic book reference would probably be up my alley, I suppose. I don't know. I'd wait and see. I mean, hey, I was excited that in an episode of Breaking Bad, once upon a time, there was a picture of a door that had a do not disturb sign hanging on it. And that actually is important to me for a totally other reason I can't talk about.
I think we're going to see that toilet that got moved out of the office. We're going to see it in the back by the dumpster, and it's going to have a red toilet lid.
Oh, well, just the toilet in general would be a nice reference to me because I spent so much time in there, and you know, it's a very important part of my life. So, anyway,
would you guys all have fairly high expectations for the mid-season finale? I personally, after the last couple episodes have been, you know, slightly slower, and you know, they're definitely setting up something, but I feel fairly confident that they will deliver on it. And if they don't, I'd be surprised.
I feel like it's going to be definitely the last 30 seconds are going to hit hard.
I think the choice to make Kim do a U-turn and slam on the gas, I think is a, you know, figurative thing to us. Next week is going to be one crazy ride, and I think we're going to be pissed. I think it's going to end, and we're going to have to wait, and we're going to be pissed, and we're going to love it.
Yep.
And it's like, actually, you know, it's against the law for her to be turning over in like one of those, like, cops can only turn over lanes on Interstate 25. There, so
well, I did notice the sign when she made the turn. There was a sign, you know, leading back, and it did say "Bad Choice Road." So, you know, they clearly weren't subtle about that. Like, oh, look at that, she made her choice to go down Bad Choice Road. They are going to end on a major cliffhanger. They're gonna make a stew for, and everyone's gonna be whining about it, and I'll be like, "Shut up! You're only waiting 7 weeks." It's not like
it's true.
It's not like in the olden times where you had to wait like several months.
Or, you know, like in COVID times.
Years.
You had to wait years.
Well, yes.
And with all the TV we have to watch in that fucking 7 weeks, it's going to take like 5 seconds to get to the next episode.
June is going to make my brain explode anyway. So the break from Better Call Saul is not going to be bad. And there'll be lots of shows and maybe even lots of podcasting to be done that month, either be solo or maybe with Jamie. The question, one more question we should throw out there. Oh, by the way, I have no idea if I have not looked. I don't know if the episode is a normal length. It probably is, or might be maybe a touch longer, but I don't know. Question is this. So we're going to get, that's going to be the seventh episode, but it's being billed as and being as the mid-season finale, whatever. Do you think we're going to see Gene? Cause we haven't gone there. It's really weird that we haven't gone there.
Nope, Gene will start the second half.
You think he'll start the second half?
That's my guess.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
There you go.
Interesting. I think you're right, but I'm gonna because I so much want to see Gene, I'm gonna say they're gonna throw us for a loop and we are gonna get a little bit of Gene. Even though I think you're right, I'm still going to say it anyway. So,
if I had to guess, I would guess we're going to go back to the house and we're going to see stuff being carried out of the house. And we're going to go back to the start of this season. They're going to put a nice bookend on it and we'll start with Gene in part two.
So we're just going to see more stuff being taken out of the house.
No, but there'll be a little more context. Like, we'll see. Like, we couldn't tell if those people were, like, liquidators or law enforcement. And I think we'll get a little more context there. That's my guess.
That's not bad. Okay. I'll give you that. And the whole thing, one of you? Well, I know it wasn't me. Didn't one of you have an idea that maybe this was some sort of proceeds from a lawsuit that Howard had gone up against him? Was it you, Brian? Was it Dan? I don't remember.
Somebody else had said, like, I think Jamie had said, like, you don't see FBI on their jackets and stuff. Or Scott, and maybe you said it too, but I had said that being the case, it could have been like seizure of property to sell by the sheriff coming and taking their property to sell to settle a judgment. So, like that is a possibility.
But I thought someone specifically said to Howard.
I did.
Okay, so that was you. So take the goddamn credit for it, Jesus Christ. I'm trying to throw. This is me throwing you a fucking bone, dude. Anyway.
but hey, don't pop quiz me at the end of an episode, Scott. I might freeze.
Well, you already froze like three or four times during this podcast. And, you know, does lovely Brian Breaks were brought to you by Bad Internet Connection. Bad Internet Connection, where you can't hear anything Brian says for at least 5 to 20 seconds.
I'm putting the band back together. It's not the broadband.
Anyway, all right. I am going to wrap this sucker up. All right, so... guys, make your goodbyes because I'll have the last word on this one.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Good night.
And remember, if you're looking for a gas giant, you don't need to look to the stars or Jupiter. You can just come right here to the STVD podcast because we're the giants of gas. Good night.